You're listening to the micro version of the Savage Lovecast, www.savagelovecast.com.
If you're stuck in a relationship quandary, or if you're looking for sexual harmony, well, there's nothing you can't ask on the Savage Lovecast.
This is outside my area of expertise, and also, footnote, I'm recording this on Monday, and you won't hear it until Tuesday, and a lot can change in 24 hours. But right now, Brett Kavanaugh is still the nominee for an open Supreme Court seat. And I have this crazy thought about this Brett Kavanaugh business, an idea, a plot, something so crazy, it just might work. Brett Kavanaugh, of course, is the rapey Federalist Society stooge that President Rapey Orange Slushy nominated to shit on the Supreme Court. As we record the top of this week's show, the Montgomery Sentinel is reporting that investigators are looking into a potential fourth sexual assault allegation against Kavanaugh. President Rapey Orange Slushy defended his nominee as unblemished shortly after the third allegation was made. So you got to wonder how many women, or how many college wrestlers for that matter, we haven't forgotten about you, Jim Jordan. You got to wonder how many women have to come forward with allegations about sexual assault before it adds up to a single blemish, at least in Trump land. Anyway, I had this idea this morning, a dangerous idea, one I'm actually a little worried about sharing with you as I was walking to work. If Kavanaugh withdraws, or if the White House yanks him, what happens next? The president nominates someone else who will do everything Kavanaugh would have done if Kavanaugh had been confirmed. Anyone Trump nominates is going to be the fifth crucial deciding vote in overturning Roe v. Wade. Anyone Trump nominates is highly likely to overturn Obergefell, the 2015 ruling that legalized same-sex marriage across the country. Anyone else that Trump nominates, like Kavanaugh, is going to rule in favor of big business and industrial polluters and against voting rights and against organized labor. So here's the thing that I started thinking on my way to work. Let's put Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court. Fatally compromised Kavanaugh. Kavanaugh, who's lied under oath before Congress on more than one occasion. Kavanaugh, sexual predator. Kavanaugh, who served in the Bush White House and worked for Kenneth Starr way, 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 way back when Republicans believed marital infidelity was grounds for impeachment. Those were the days. Anyway, Republicans have blocked the release of millions of pages of documents related to Kavanaugh's quote-unquote service in the Bush White House and on the Starr Commission. And those documents are going to come out in the next year after Kavanaugh's on the Supreme Court if he got confirmed, which maybe, just maybe, he should be. Because if we don't confirm this piece of shit, we're going to get some other piece of Federalist Society shit. But someone who doesn't have Kavanaugh's baggage, someone who doesn't have Kavanaugh's record of allegedly attacking women and of perjuring himself before Congress. It is a high-stakes gamble, I realize, but bear with me. If the Dems allowed Kavanaugh to be confirmed on a party-line vote, which they don't really have the power to prevent, then take back the House and Senate in November, which is looking ever more likely, in January of next year, the Dems will be able to point to the sexual assault allegations and the perjury and whatever documents will be coming out about Kavanaugh and impeach the motherfucker. Congress can impeach a sitting Supreme Court justice. It takes a majority vote in the House to impeach and a two-third majority in the Senate to convict and remove. And yeah, that two-third bar is set awfully high. Even if the Dems should take back the Senate, they're not going to have enough seats to convict Kavanaugh on their own. But if more and worse keeps coming out, and if Republicans, as looks likely even if Kavanaugh isn't confirmed, pay a political price for floating and then polishing and then confirming this turd, maybe enough of the remaining R's in the Senate will break and vote to remove Kavanaugh from the court after he's been impeached, fingers crossed. It is a chance, and it is a long shot, and it is a Hail Mary pass, but you put fatally compromised Kavanaugh on the court and then you remove him, what do you got? You got a 4-4 tie. Liberals versus conservatives, just like we had for that whole year after Antonin Scalia died. No 5-4 conservative majority means no overturning Roe or Obergefell or Griswold. And post-impeaching Kavanaugh? Dems, of course, should refuse to even consider the nomination of anyone whose initials aren't Merrick fucking Garland. The president can nominate whatever Federalist Society stooges he wants to until Mueller or a blocked coronary artery, whichever comes first, ends Trump's presidency. I don't want to see a rapey, sexual harassy piece of shit on the Supreme Court. Well, I don't want to see any more sexual harassy pieces of shit on the Supreme Court in addition to the one sexual harassy piece of shit we already have on the Supreme Court. I don't want to see Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court more than anyone else. But if we don't get Kavanaugh, we're going to get somebody without Kavanaugh's impeachable flaws. And that somebody, likely to sail through the nomination process, likely to be the crucial fifth vote. I would prefer that 4-4 tie to that crucial fifth vote. And if that means Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court for a few months before he can be impeached, might be the better choice. All right, coming up on this week's show, on the micro-free edition of the Savage Lovecast, tons of your Q's, lots of my A's, and on the Magnum subscription edition of the Savage Lovecast, twice as long and no ads. You can subscribe at savagelovecast.com. Liz Winstead, founder of The Daily Show, also founder of Lady Parts Justice, joins us to take a couple of calls and to talk of the Golden Probes in New York in November. All that coming up today's show. The Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Casper, mattresses made by humans for humans. Get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/savage and using the promo code SAVAGE at checkout.
This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Lola, bringing you 100% organic feminine care products. For 40% off subscriptions, visit mylola.com and enter SAVAGE to get started.
This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Everlane, luxury basic clothing and accessories made at ethical factories without those retail markups. For free shipping and to support the Lovecast, go to everlane.com/savage.
Hi, Dan. 46-year-old, bisexual male living in D.C. I've had two relationships in the past 20 years, one for 12 and one for 7-ish. Both ended with the other person cheating. And now I'm like, I don't know what to do. I don't know that I want to be in a relationship if it's just going to end in 5 to 7 years. I feel like that's wasted time, but I don't really know what to do. I'm dating a really nice trans guy who I actually really like, but I feel myself pulling away from him when I want to be getting closer because I don't want to get attached and don't want to get hurt again. I've been single now for almost a year, and I don't really know what to do. My sister is like this person who doesn't need anybody. She lives on her own. She has two kids by herself, and that she doesn't need anybody. I want to be like that, but that is not me, and I don't really know where to go from here.
If you don't want to get hurt again, don't get in a relationship ever again. Even if in all of your future relationships, in this relationship that you're in now, or any relationship you might be in after, the odds, the risks of getting hurt are about 100%. Not the risk of getting cheated on again at 100%, but all long-term committed relationships, that kind of intimacy, there will be pain. There will be hurt. Both parties will cause each other hurt over time, and both parties will need to find it within themselves, alternately, to forgive. Because forgiveness is the grease that makes it possible for the gears and machinery of a relationship to grind on. Some people, of course, find it within themselves to forgive an infidelity. We rarely hear about those people. Often when someone cheats, the only person who found out, besides the person they cheated with, was their partner. And if their partner forgives them and takes them back and tries to make it work, they typically don't broadcast that because they don't want to be seen as pathetic. They don't want people to judge them for staying. Maybe they don't want people to judge their partner for cheating. Sometimes dealing with the anger and resentment of our friends or our family after we've forgiven a cheating partner and moved on is exhausting for the cheated on partner. It's the cheated on partner who often has to field and deflect grief, questions, even anger coming from others, third parties, people who aren't in the relationship who believe they should be able to dictate to the people who are in the relationship how and when it should end. Anyway, it's a long digression about cheating and forgiving, but if you don't want to ever risk being hurt ever again, don't ever date ever again. Because as I like to say, every relationship you're ever going to be in is going to end until one doesn't. You don't know which one that is until you're in it and you die or they die. Till you get to that death do you part thing and you get to spike the relationship football in the funeral home end zone. You just never know. And you have to be willing to suspend your disbelief. You have to be open to being hurt again to be in a relationship. Look around. How many people do you know who are with the very first person they started dating at 15 or 20 or 25? How many people do you know over their entire adult lives are with their first love? Very, very few. Which means people have gotten hurt, people have gotten dumped, people have gotten cheated on, people have grown apart, relationships have blown up, people have touched the stove and gotten badly burned and then turned around 6 months later or a year later and touched basically the same goddamn stove, that relationship stove. Got to be willing to risk some pain to have the relationship that you want to be in. There's just no way of avoiding that.
Hi, Dan. I'm a 20-year-old queer woman from New York City. I'm dating two women on and off right now. It's still in the early phases. Both of them do not like being touched in any way. They like their vagina rubbed, but nothing, no penetration. They do not like the idea of me going down on either of them. They don't know each other either, by the way. It's something that I've had before where I've dated women who are for self-proclaimed tops and they don't like to receive, and that's fine. But it, with these women, I feel like it's something more like they're self-conscious. And I'm not sure how to let them know to trust me, and it's totally okay. I haven't even had the opportunity to like go down on them at all, let alone like really see their vagina. So I'm not really sure what to do about that and how to make my partner feel comfortable and trusted. And I know that this is a common thread for some lesbians in my circle. So I wanted to hear about you and maybe your viewers, if they had any input as well.
I would file do not like to be touched in any way under not in good working order. Now, maybe there are women out there who would be good matches for these women that you're dating right now who do not like to be touched in any way except to be rubbed against, which is a form of touch. There is one way, some way, they like to be touched, but they don't like to be touched in the way you would like to touch a woman that you're dating. You would like to be able to have a look at her vagina. You would like to be able to go down on her. You would like to experiment or incorporate some penetration play. So whatever the root causes might be for the reason why these two women don't want to be touched in the way you want to touch them, really irrelevant. They're just not the right partners for you. You're not sexually compatible with these women. They're limitations, whatever their root cause again might be, kind of disqualify them from being your girlfriend because, again, they don't want to be touched the way you would like to touch your girlfriend. And you can have that conversation with them. And you should tell them when you have that conversation that you don't want to manipulate them emotionally or coerce them into consenting to engage in sex play under duress just to keep you. Sex play, which if what's at bottom here is a history of sexual trauma or sexual violence, could be triggering for them to engage in. You don't want them consenting to that. You don't want to make them unhappy. You would like to be with a woman who wants to be touched in the ways you would like to touch a woman who'll derive pleasure from that kind of touch. And if they aren't those women, then they're friends, not girlfriends. Then you should keep searching until you find a woman who can be touched the way you want to touch the woman that you happen to be dating, which is more than just rubbing off against. You can handle this compassionately, and you can give them an out. And there are, as you said, in lesbian land, there are sexual and relationship dynamics just like this, where one person is done to. One person gets her pussy eaten, one person maybe is on the receiving end of penetration, and the other person is kind of the top and doesn't want to be touched or doesn't want to receive touch. The girl who wants to be the doomy bottom, who just lays there receiving and doesn't really want to touch, is the better potential future partner for either or both of these women than you are. So resist the urge to get under the hood and repair these women. I know I said at the beginning of my response, maybe they're not in good working order, and the temptation then is to set someone right, is to take them off to the shop or pack them off to the shrink for repairs. But if this is how they function and this is how they're comfortable and they're not interested in making repairs and they're not interested in working on this, you don't have to commit to them. You don't have to commit to this relationship. You don't have to accept their limitations, which they may not experience as limitations. They may be very happy with who they are sexually and how they function sexually. It's just they're not going to be happy with you because you're not going to be happy with them. So they're not motherfuckers, but some dumping is in order here.
Hey, it's Nancy. This episode is brought to you by Lola. It's a female-founded company offering a line of organic cotton tampons, pads, and liners, and now a line of sex products made with women in mind. Lola makes your month a little easier. If you get a subscription, you can choose your mix of products with the perfect mix of absorbency, your number of boxes, and frequency of delivery. And it's super flexible, so you can change, skip, or cancel anytime. Choose from organic cotton tampon pads or liners, or add a box of each. And the Sex by Lola line is now also available for subscription. You can add it to your period subscription so everything's conveniently delivered on your ideal schedule. And their stuff is really nice. They sent me a sampler pack of all their goods, and I was impressed by how clearly it's all geared toward women. It's tasteful, it's simple, there's no creepy chemicals. And there's more. You do some good when you buy stuff from them. For every purchase, Lola donates feminine care products to homeless shelters across the U.S. And if I had a kid going off to college, I would totally get my kid a subscription. That's a practical, loving gift right there. Maybe I'll get that opportunity one day. Anyway, for 40% off subscriptions, visit mylola.com and enter Savage to get started. That's mylola.com and enter Savage.
Hi, Dan. I desperately need your help. I'm a 28-year-old lesbian living in New York City. I started dating this woman for about a month now. We see each other once, twice a week, and we make out, we cuddle, we go on dates, go out for dinner, but we have not had sex yet, and that's super weird for me because normally I sleep with someone on like the first or second date. So that's strange. We've even like cuddled in bed, naked, watching a movie, and like nothing's happened. I'm not really sure what to make of it, or like, are we in the friend zone? Maybe she's like self-conscious. I don't know. I know I have my insecurities. I'm just really confused. And I did actually send her a text being like, you know, what's going on? That night that we slept in the same bed together, half naked. And she wrote, oh, I was really scared from the movie. Like, that's why she didn't want to hook up. Sounds like an excuse to me. Wanted to hear your thoughts.
Not just an excuse, but a transparently bullshittery excuse. I was scared from the movie. We all live for scary movies. They get our adrenaline pumping. That risk-fear response actually typically is arousing. People go see scary movies or they watch a scary movie at home and then they fuck. That is how scary movies work for most of us. So that does seem like a reach to me that, oh, well, yeah, we were naked in bed and we've been dating for a month. And but that one time we could have had sex that one night. We watched a scary movie. I ate a burrito. My grandmother appeared in a vision over the bed staring at me. Bullshit, bullshit, bullshit. Something's up. You've only been dating this woman for a month. How experienced is she? Are you her first girlfriend? You're relatively young. Is she relatively young? It could be just anxiety and nerves around really tiptoeing across that threshold. There is wanting to date women, wanting to be with the same sex partner. And then there is finding yourself in bed with a woman with the same sex partner and having a mini freak out about what it will mean if you cross that Rubicon or that Ruby Fruit Jungle-icon and have the lesbian sex that you've been fantasizing about. Because there's thinking about it and the emotional ramifications of that and the internalized homophobia that that can trigger. And then there's the doing it. And the emotional ramifications from that, potentially, and the internalized homophobia that can trigger are much bigger, scarier. And she may be wrestling with that. But I don't know. You texted her and asked her what was up, and all you got back was, scary movie was up. Not good enough. You want a girlfriend, like the previous caller, you want a girlfriend that you can be intimate with, you can have sex with. If after a month, after this investment you've made of a month's time and many dates and sleepovers and scary movies, she can't get there and can't tell you if or when she'll ever get there, you need to stop wasting your time on her. True story. When Casper Mattresses began advertising on the podcast, they offered me a free mattress so I could try out their mattresses, but I had a mattress I was perfectly content with. So I gave that free Casper mattress to a friend for his guest room, where then I stayed and slept on that Casper mattress and realized that I had made a terrible, terrible mistake because it was a terrific fucking mattress. It was so much better than the mattress we had at home, the mattress that I thought I liked. And I got such a great night's sleep on that mattress. And so I went home and I ordered at full price. I didn't even think to use the discount that I was offering my listeners. I ordered at full price a Casper mattress for me and Terry, and that is the mattress that we are still sleeping and other thinging on to this day. We got a Casper mattress for our guest room. We got a Casper mattress for our son's room. We went Casper mattress crazy. We kind of Casper mattress binged because it really is that good. We are a Casper mattress household, and you, if you value a good night's sleep on a really super comfortable mattress, your household should be a Casper mattress household too. Because Casper is the sleep brand that continues to revolutionize its line of products. They are continuing to create an exceptionally comfortable sleep experience, one night at a time. And these mattresses, they are designed by humans for humans. The original Casper mattress combines multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. And Casper's breathable design helps you sleep cool, which is really important to me. I like a cool room and a cool bed. And the design helps to regulate your body temperature through the night so you won't be kicking blankets on and off and waking up because you're too hot. They're not just a mattress company, though. Casper offers a wide array of products to ensure an overall better sleep experience, and Casper's mattresses are made in the USA. Buying the Casper is easy. You order online, it's delivered to your door in a compact box, and they offer free shipping and free returns to the US and Canada. Considering we spend a third of our lives on our mattresses, it's important to truly sleep on a mattress before committing. That is why Casper gives you 100 nights to try their mattress out. Get $50 toward select mattresses by visiting casper.com/savage and using the promo code SAVAGE at checkout. Do not make the mistake I made. Do not fail to use the promo code SAVAGE at checkout because you will get the $50 off that I didn't get if you use the promo code. Terms and conditions apply. That's $50 toward a select mattress by visiting casper.com/savage and using the promo code SAVAGE at checkout.
Yeah, Dan. My name is Kyle, and I actually have two questions. So number one, you know what I'm saying? I've basically been suffering from high blood pressure, which actually leads to ED, and it's kind of been interfering with my relationships or whatever. And I kind of mastered the oral arts, and it just doesn't seem to work really well. you know what I'm saying? And trust me, I'm damn good at it. You know what I'm saying? But I guess I just been, you know, wondering, I don't know where to proceed. I mean, and then too, you know, this is a really new thing, and I kind of been, you know, depending on, you know, my penis really for all my relationship needs. And I guess I just don't know what to do without it, I guess. And I didn't want to like redefine myself as somebody who can't have a relationship without his penis. So, and my second question is, so, how to tell my parents that since I haven't had my penis, the use of my penis in a while, that I've actually been discovering other ways to be, you know, satisfied without it. Kind of like my very conservative parents. All right.
Your parents do not need to know what is up with your dick. This is the best example I think I've ever gotten of your parents don't need to know. You run your parents on a need-to-know basis about your adult relationships and your adult sex life, and your parents absolutely positively do not need to know that you're experiencing erectile dysfunction at this time, and consequently, you're eating a lot more pussy than you used to. That's just not something, even if your parents were liberal and sexually adventurous, and you guys routinely joked about your sex, they don't need to know this. And I promise you, conservative or liberal, your parents don't want to know this unless your sexual problems are causing you such distress that you're engaged in acts of self-harm or you're worried you might be or you might become suicidal. Then maybe you would have to go to your parents and tell them what is up. If you need their help dealing with a problem that ties back to your sexuality, maybe then, but not now, not in this circumstance. So starting with your second question, don't worry about what to tell your parents because you are not going to tell your parents anything about your dick right now. The person you're going to talk to about your dick is your doctor. You're going to talk to your doctor about getting your blood pressure under control, and you're going to talk to the doctor about whether there are any boner pills out there that are safe for you to take with your condition and with the meds you're on for the high blood pressure. And you're going to communicate to your partners that because of a medical condition, your dick isn't entirely reliable, but your fingers are always hard and your forearm's always hard and your tongue is available for service and you're good at it. And you can lay in a few penetration toys to keep around the house if you want to go above and beyond the call of duty. But tongue and finger and forearm and vibrators and dildos, all of that is a path for a guy with erectile dysfunction problems to get their partner off. Also to take the pressure off their dick in the moment, because if it's understood going into the sex that your dick probably won't be involved, then you're not going to be worried every moment about the revelation that your dick isn't going to get hard and your partner's disappointment, because your partner will go into that sex with their expectations adjusted, not lowered, adjusted, or other kinds of sex play that they enjoy. I get calls, sir, I get calls every day from women who are into PIV, enjoy PIV, but it doesn't get them off. It's not their favorite thing. Their favorite thing is getting eaten out, being gone down on. So you may wind up in bed with a few women who miss the PIV so much that you're not the right partner for them. But there's also a really good chance you're going to wind up in bed with a woman who PIV just isn't her top priority, isn't her main interest, isn't her preferred route to sexual pleasure and climax. So just put yourself out there. Tell your truth, not to your parents. Tell your truths to your potential sex partners. And the ones who require the D, always available, always hard, they're going to fall away. And you'll be left with the ones, or the one partner who enjoys you, enjoys oral, enjoys digital stimulation, enjoys toys. And when your dick does rise to the occasion, enjoys that too. Good luck. I'm not a fashion model, as anyone who's ever seen me in public or on television can attest. My husband kind of is. And we, me, not a fashion model, Terry, kind of is a fashion model. We are both happy with the clothes we're getting from Everlane. Everlane first started with a basic t-shirt and a simple but bold idea that they could set a new standard for the retail industry, a new standard built on three pillars. Pillar number one, Everlane makes beautiful, long-lasting products, so they only use high-quality materials, and they are trend-averse. They are not a fast fashion brand that leads to a lot of waste in the retail industry and a lot of waste in your closet and a lot of trips to Goodwill. Instead, they're focused on making classic clothing that can be used and worn year after year after year. Pillar two, ethics. Everlane only works with ethical factories, constantly vetting and evaluating factors like fair wages and safety. They're also environmentally conscious. For example, their denim factory, unlike most manufacturers that produce tons of waste, recycles 98% of its water waste, repurposes byproduct, and sends it off to a local brick factory, which then gets used to build affordable housing. Transparency in pricing, that's pillar number three. Everlane reveals how much each item costs, from materials to labor to transportation, and, revolutionarily, they reveal what their markup is. They believe their customers have a right to know how much their clothes cost to make. Pillars one, two, and three aside, the best part about Everlane, their timeless essentials are just what you're looking for. No frills, just quality. Terry and I love the clothing we've gotten from Everlane, and so does Nancy, and she hates clothing. Fun fact about Nancy, she'd rather not be wearing any clothes at all, but she's wearing Everlane right now. And right now you can check out my personalized collection at everlane.com/savage. Plus, you'll get free shipping on your first order. That's everlane.com/savage. Everlane.com/savage.
G'day, Dan. My wife and I have been together for 21 years. We've been monogamish for probably around five, I think. Anyway, recently we had a phone syncing fuck up where my wife, with a momentary lapse of reason, signed into her iTunes account on our 9-year-old daughter's phone without realizing that this would sync the photos feed. And in the photos feed were some very graphic BDSM photos of my wife with her long-term boyfriend of about 3 years. And the 9-year-old saw these. Now, luckily in their relationship, my wife is the dom. And so it wasn't like she saw her mother, you know, bound and gagged and handcuffed and all this sort of stuff. It was quite the reverse. In fact, we sometimes have been laughing in the last couple of days since this happened. But my wife's black, African-American, and her boyfriend, we're in Australia at the moment, is a white guy, and there's probably something psychologically beneficial of seeing your black mum beating up a white guy. But that's a small silver lining. But nonetheless, the 9-year-old has, you know, seen these photos, and obviously that required a blunt conversation with her about us not being a monogamous couple. We've handled the conversation as best as we possibly can. Again, the photos are pretty graphic, and so it's only 2 days ago that this happened, and the 9-year-old's still a little, like, weirded out, which is totally fine. We've reiterated that nothing changes for her, that we both really love each other. We're going to talk to the 15-year-old tonight just to make sure that we're not having the 9-year-old have a secret. But, you know, nonetheless, just want to make sure we're doing this as best as we possibly can. We just don't want to leave any, particularly from the BDSM angle, and I'm not kink-shaming, I hope, but just make sure that we're handling this conversation, particularly with the 9-year-old. It's just a little bit bloody young. As sensitively as we possibly can. So I'm just curious if you have any tips or advice for how to handle this conversation moving forward, or what we should do moving forward. Just drop it from now, talk more, I don't know. And also curious if you had any friends with, you've got so many friends with experience in the kink communities. How do they come out or talk to their children? At what age? Has anyone else been busted and how did they handle it? And if any of your callers have experience of either being busted and how they handled it, or busting their parents and what was the impact on them, I'd just be really fascinated to know.
So if there's anyone out there listening who's been busted and kink shamed by their kids, please give us a call. Tell us how that went. If there's anyone out there who's kinky or poly and came out to their kids and had these conversations and they're 10 years in the past and you feel it went really well and there weren't a lot of negative repercussions, give us a call, share your experience with those conversations. I would advise you to drop it. I would advise you to touch base with the 15-year-old. I think that's really important that the 9-year-old doesn't have the burden of keeping secrets from siblings. It doesn't have the burden or the weapon of having a secret on mom and dad. So yeah, I would come out to the 15-year-old about it. And I would apologize to the 9-year-old that this was an accident. And now you know something about your parents that you probably had a right not to know, certainly no need to know at your age. But relationships are complicated. Not every relationship is monogamous. A relationship can be committed without being monogamous. And sex is about pleasure and fun. And sometimes it's about dress up and make believe. And a small child can understand make believe. They know what sex is and they know what dress up and pretend is. And explaining to them that one of the things some adults like to do is continue to play dress up as adults and incorporate that into their adult sex life as well. And there's nothing wrong with that. And there's nothing wrong with what your mother was doing. This is a great opportunity to have a conversation generally and broadly about consent and what consent means and how play, that adult play, can sometimes look scary, but it's like a scary movie. It's just pretend. And then fucking drop it. And then tell her if she has any questions. She can always ask you about anything. And then fucking drop it. And let her ask. If she asks and answer questions like you would from a child, she may come to you needing reassurance. It is scary for a kid who's assumed, because it is the default setting, that their parents are monogamous and monogamy means love and love means monogamy and monogamy means commitment and commitment means monogamy, to find out their parents aren't monogamous. They can worry that this means the relationship that is their everything, that is their whole world, their sense of safety and security is vulnerable. And really, there's only so much you can do to reassure a child verbally. You have to prove it to them through the passage of time. So she may be insecure and concerned for a little bit. She may think your relationship is going to collapse in the next few months, and then a few months will go by and it hasn't. And then a year will go by and it hasn't, and a couple of years will go by and it hasn't. And gradually she will become secure in the permanence of your primary relationship. But that will take some time. Again, if there are others out there, parents who are kinky or poly, who came out to their kids or were outed by technology or outed by snooping kids themselves, give us a call. Let us know how you handled it. 206-302-2064.
Hi, Dan. So this is about my neighbor. We live in kind of a complex that's rent stabilized in New York City. And I'm calling you because he's been dropping some suggestive shit that I'm not comfortable with. And part of this is the fact that a previous neighbor that moved out, she said that he flashed her. And quite frankly, I didn't actually believe her that this happened. And she moved out of the building to a different state, whatever. It wasn't really important to the story. But anyway, so in the last couple months, he had a daughter. And our dogs are friendly. I actually got my dog through him. He has since, in the last couple months, been a little more aggressive texting things, pictures. And a lot of the pictures, he just had a baby, and a lot of the pictures are of him in his underwear that are extremely suggestive. So he'll send a picture initially that's of the baby, and there's maybe an arm in it. And then the follow-up picture is of him a little bit more so with his underwear, and it's very obvious he's, you know, unclothed with the baby. And most recently, actually tonight, he sent me a picture of himself fully unclothed with like giant erect dick in the picture. And I love his wife. I know his wife. She's awesome. I guess on a superficial level, he seems to be a great person, and he did a lot of advocacy work for reinstating our rent stabilization and all that stuff. But, you know, he's also a bit of a pervert. So I sent her the text message with the picture that he just sent me, and just let her know I'm not going to associate with this person anymore. We had been doing these kind of quote-unquote play dates with our dogs, and I feel somewhat conflicted by the fact that, you know, he's done a lot of good things, but at the same time, he's obviously a pervert. So I'm not really sure what I'm looking for you at this point, but I guess I feel bad for blowing up this family dynamic in light of these events. And I guess I'm sort of looking for an outside perspective. I'm not sure whether or not I did the right thing.
Believe the women, as they say. Your previous neighbor told you that this guy flashed her, and that's why she at least had to move out of that apartment. She moved out of state, you said. She really wanted to get as far away from this guy as possible. And you didn't believe her because he seemed to be a good and decent dude. And some guys who are boundaryless perverts. I am pro-pervert. I think perversions can be delightful, but a pervert without boundaries is a pervert who's going to violate people's sense of safety and security. It's a pervert who's not going to respect the basic principle of consent, which was the case here. You didn't want or solicit these photos of him undressed with his infant daughter, nor did you solicit or welcome this photo of his erect penis. So there are a lot of guys out there who are doing decent and good things. Some of these guys do those decent and good things as a form of camouflage so that they get a pass for the not good and indecent things that they do. And sometimes they do these good and decent things intentionally so that when people say, hey, this person did this shitty indecent thing, no one will believe them, in the sense that you didn't believe this woman who told you that this guy was flashing her. Because he seemed so nice, he seemed so good, and he'd never shown you his dick. Well, now he's shown you his dick. People generally don't lie about this shit. Somebody tells you somebody flashed them, probably telling the truth. All that said, I think you did the right thing, letting his wife know about this. It's hard not to think of Anthony Weiner and Huma Abedin in this context. I'm sure she would have liked to know earlier, perhaps before it made the newspapers, what Anthony was up to. So I think you did the right thing, letting her know that this is fucked up and that he is doing this. And involving their child, if she needs to get the fuck away from this guy, if he has a compulsion that he cannot control, if he has a problem, easier to get away from him now while the child is young than to get away from him in 5 years or 2.5 years, or get away from him or divorce him after he's in trouble with the law and runs up a lot of legal debts that she would then be on the hook for. Yeah, no, you did the right thing telling his wife. You need to also tell him to knock it the fuck off. You never mentioned when the pictures first started coming, the inappropriate pictures first started coming. And I'm not blaming you for the arrival of the unsolicited erect dick pic, but you didn't say when the pictures first started coming that you told him to stop, that you didn't welcome this. Now, sometimes you tell someone who's basically a flasher to stop, and that excites them more, and it continues and gets worse, and that's when you involve the authorities or the spouses to create some accountability. Anyway, in conclusion, to wrap this up, you did the right thing telling the wife, and that may be the solution to all of your problems, because that creepy, boundaryless perv may not be living in that apartment with his wife and his child for much longer.
Hi, Dan. I'm a 29-year-old cisgendered female from the Midwest and I'm calling with a parenting question. I've been in a relationship for about 2 years. I'm living together for one, and we are great, and everything is wonderful. Our relationship is really strong, and he has two young kids who I absolutely adore and love. The problem is that I am not a morning person. During the weekdays, I get up an hour before I need to get ready so that I can walk my dog, and that's my time to get myself ready for the day. On the weekends, however, his kids come into our room anywhere between 5:30 and 7 in the morning for morning cuddles, and I don't get that hour to wake up. And so my question is, what can I do so that I am not taking out my morning crankiness on the kids and to encourage and maintain the family ritual of morning cuddles without being a bear to them?
They will outgrow this. This is a problem that's going to solve itself in time, and you may just have to eat it for the moment and find it within yourself during the morning cuddle ritual to be as nice as you possibly can. And that can involve welcoming the kids and then rolling over and pretending to fall back asleep so that they give their full attention to their dad. If it really does bother you, and it would bother me being woken up at 5:30 in the morning, you can ask your partner to intercept the kids on those weekend mornings, that at 5:36, he should get up and go to the couch and have the kids come to him there and have the morning cuddle ritual, not in the bed where you're trying to get enough sleep so you're not a monster all day, but out in the living room with dad. That said, it's really hard to get little kids not to do what these little kids are doing. So the intervention can't be on the kids, a talking to, a scolding, a punishing. No, it's going to have to be on you to roll over and go back to sleep, or on him to take the cuddle party to the living room and the sofa out of consideration for your need for a little bit more sleep. And again, look forward to the very near future when they won't be doing this anymore. I promise you. 7-8-year-old kids, they don't do this.
Hi, Dan. I'd like to preface my question with a very short story. So this past weekend, I was at my boyfriend's house, and I went to the bathroom after breakfast, number two, and I came out, and he kind of approached me, and we started having sex, doggy style, and he was kind of like playing with my butt, and he ended up putting his finger in there, and then he was like, I really want your butt, and I was like, well, I don't know if it's the best time, because I just got in the bathroom, and he took his finger out of my butt and smelled it, and was like, okay, I think it's fine, and I was mortified. So going forward, I would just like to know when you think is the best time to have anal so that I can avoid my boyfriend sticking his finger up my butt and smelling it, to declare whether or not it is a safe time. It may be totally irrational to think that it's never a good time, but I really don't know. I'm kind of new to this, so any advice would be appreciated. Thank you.
Going forward, the best time to have anal sex is when you want to have anal sex. And at that moment, when he said, I want your butt, you did not want to have anal sex. And so what you needed to give him was an emphatic no, not now. Not ready, don't want to, butt's not on the menu right now. Instead, you said, maybe this isn't the best time, which he took as an opening for him to do a science experiment where he could test that hypothesis, where he could see if indeed it wasn't the best time. And that's when he pulled his fingers out of your butt and smelled them and determined to his satisfaction that it was a good time, that you were good to go. But it wasn't a good time for you because you had just taken a shit and you were self-conscious and therefore tense, and tension and self-consciousness and anal don't go together well. So regardless of whether you took a kind of fiber-rich clean out the ducts dump that left you at no risk of shitting all over his dick, or you were going to Santorumize his cock in the process, that's irrelevant. Doesn't matter whether you were good to go or not. You didn't want to go. And when somebody doesn't want to have anal sex, they should say so. And when someone hesitates about having anal sex, particularly a woman hesitates about having anal sex, the guy shouldn't read that as, let's have a science experiment to see if we're good to go and we can go for it. The guy needs to back the fuck off and get the fuck off your ass. Clearly, your boyfriend isn't sensitive enough to take your hint that you didn't wanna as an answer, and he pushed on. And sounds like in the end, he got your butt. You need to commit now to not being ambiguous about this going forward. You need to say to your boyfriend, the other day when we had anal, I didn't really want to have it. Maybe I sent you a mixed message. Maybe in the context of our socializations, mine as a woman, you as a man, it led to sex happening that I didn't want. Because when I said, maybe this isn't the best time, I meant no, but I didn't say no. And you, as the male in this situation, didn't read a no in there. And I shouldn't rely on you to be psychic, and I shouldn't hesitate to say no when the answer is no. So in the future, when you ask me if I want to have butt sex, I'm not going to be ambiguous. I'm going to say no when it's no. And it was no the other day. And so I don't feel great about that, sticking your fingers in my ass and giving them a smell and telling me I'm good to go when I wasn't good to go. Period. The end. Zooming out to the poop issue. Poop is, of course, anal sex's everlasting, ongoing PR disaster. Shit happens. There's shit in butts. And you're at risk for getting shit on something if you're going to have anal sex. It's just unknown known. And if you are uncomfortable with that or will be devastated by getting shit on your dick or shitting on someone else's dick, maybe anal isn't for you. You do need to know your butt. And you can know, for the most part, when you are good to go. Some people have it in their heads that their rear ends or their partner's rear ends are like chocolate frozen yogurt dispensers in the back of a Tasty Freeze in Texas during a brownout, kind of always dripping. Not true. That if you have well-formed stools after you have a bowel movement, it's not like it's a shit-streaked room in there. You are pretty much good to go. Your rectal mucus slid that turd along and you are empty and clean. If you want reassurance, you can douche anally. And some people, their diets aren't so great or their bowel movements aren't so solid. Maybe they should take fiber pills, get a little more fruit and veg in their diets, and create those firm stools that mean empty when you're empty. But poop's always a risk. Douching is a pretty effective way to avoid that risk. All that said, if you're not feeling it, if you enjoy anal sometimes and you aren't feeling it in the moment, that is always, always the wrong moment for you to have anal, regardless of how your partner feels about anal at that moment or about how you smell or whether you're ready. It's not up to them when it comes to anal or anything else to determine if you're ready. That's your call to make.
This is a message for the gentleman, the 29-year-old who's beginning to open up his relationship with his 11-year common law wife. Dan's advice is pretty good. The other thing I would add is someone whose marriage is now crumbling because we opened it in a horrible way, go see a therapist. Do not wait. Go see a therapist together, a sex positive therapist. Dan has brought them up before in the past. They can help you navigate these very troubled waters, A and B. Accept the fact that one or both of you were going to mess up and drive the other person nuts into a very scary place and might panic, and talk about that with the therapist, with each other, and say, look, things are going to go unexpectedly. You might realize that this bothers you more than you thought it would after the fact. Together, if you're both in it, you can navigate it properly. But asking for forgiveness after the fact is a surefire way to torpedo your relationship. See a therapist, talk to each other honestly and openly, and maybe you guys can do what I failed.
Hi, I'm responding to the man who calls in episode 621 about explaining polyamory to his 5-year-old daughter. I'm a person in my 30s whose parents had an open relationship starting when I was 6. It was kept a secret until I was 13 when I learned about it just before my parents split up for other reasons. While it was absolutely devastating to feel like my home had a giant secret for my whole childhood, even as a 13-year-old, I was able to identify that I wouldn't have been able to handle knowing that my parents had other relationships, let alone spend time with them. So as an adult even, it's been emotionally exhausting developing relationships with all of my parents' various partners. And I work in education, and I pretty firmly believe it's not developmentally appropriate to expect your school-age child to not only comprehend polyamory, but also to make her spend time with other partners. You may feel like you would be keeping your kids from your other partners and not living authentically, but your job is to be her parent right now, not involve her in your marriage when she's 10 maybe, but I still feel like it's unfair to expect your kids to emotionally attach to more than one partner. Remember, it's your choice to be polyamorous. It's not your kid.
Hi, Dan. This call is in response to the person that didn't know how to answer back to those that were asking if they were going to have kids. What I usually tell people is that my husband got us a vasectomy for our wedding present, and that usually shuts them up. It was the best present I've ever gotten, and kudos to Planned Parenthood for making that happen.
And we're going to leave it there. 206-302-2064 is the number here at the Savage Lovecast. If you have a question or a comment, and I bet a bunch of you have comments about the top of this week's show, give us a call, 206-302-2064. Hump, the 13th annual Hump, My Dirty Little Film Festival, is still out there on the road touring this week. You can catch it in Denver, Colorado, Missoula, Montana, Portland, Maine, and Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. Head over to humpfilmfest.com/tour to get tickets. And last week, in the very room where I'm sitting, the Hump jury met to pick the 21 films that will be playing in the all-new 14th annual Hump Film Festival that kicks off in Seattle, Portland, Olympia, and San Francisco in November. Go to humpfilmfest.com right now to get tickets to the premiere of the 14th annual Hump Film Festival. Follow me on Twitter at FakeDanSavage. Follow Liz Winstead on Twitter at Liz Winstead. The Savage Lovecast is produced every week by Nancy Hartunian, and me and the tech-savvy at-risk youth and Nancy will all be back at you next week with an installment of the Savage Lovecast. Thanks for downloading.